I spent a week thinking about whether I should go to Alaska. At first, the whole idea felt completely insane. It seemed like something a desperate person would do. But then it occurred to me that other people on that forum, people who'd never met Maddie before, might see the photograph and decide to go looking for themselves. I realized I had a responsibility to get there first, to find her before someone else did. I bought a one-way ticket to Anchorage, departing December 3rd without thinking twice about the return flight. I figured I'd sort that out once I got there. My entire plan consisted of showing up at the Bush Pilot Supply Store and hoping the man who'd made that post would somehow help me to find her. That was really it. I hadn't spent one second thinking about where I'd stay, what I'd actually say to Maddie if I found her, or what I'd do if the whole thing turned out to be nothing. I just knew I had to go, and everything else felt like details I could work out later. I spent an entire day searching for a way to contact one of the Longbaughs. I needed to tell them I was going to Alaska and that I might have found Maddie. It felt like something I owed them. It was simply an obligation I couldn't ignore before getting on that plane. The problem was I hadn't seen or spoken to any of them in over 10 years. After the trial ended, the family had withdrawn from the neighborhood entirely. Tyler's parents sold the house in 1985 and moved somewhere downstate. Tyler himself went to college and never came back to Glen Falls. I'd heard he was living in Boston now, working in finance or something. Cheryl had stayed in South Carolina after graduation. I tried searching online for phone numbers, but everything I found was outdated. The listings I pulled up were disconnected or belonged to different people entirely. After nearly 3 hours of dead ends, I finally found what looked like Cheryl's current phone number through some professional networking site where she'd listed herself as a real estate agent in Charleston. I called Cheryl's number twice the night before my flight and got her voicemail both times. I couldn't bring myself to leave a message either time. I just hung up and stared at my phone, feeling like an idiot. Finally, the third time I called, I forced myself to speak after the tone. I told her who I was and that I knew it had been years and that I was sorry to call out nowhere like this. Then I explained I was going to Alaska to try to find someone I thought might be Maddie. I gave her my number and asked her to call me back if she got the message. After I hung up, I sat there in my apartment for a long while, thinking about how insane that voicemail must have sounded. Some guy she hadn't spoken to in over a decade, calling to say he was flying across the continent, chasing what might be her presumably dead sister. I left from Syracuse at 5 on the morning of December 3rd and ended up catching a connection in Toronto. The closer I got to Alaska, the more deranged the entire plan seemed. I kept running through different scenarios in my head about what I might say to Maddie if I actually found her. But nothing felt right. When the plane finally landed around 4 p.m. in Anchorage, I stepped off into the main terminal, and it finally hit me how completely unprepared I was for any of this. It was already completely dark outside, despite being only 4 o'clock. I stood there in the arrivals area with just a small duffel bag, watching people move purposely around me, while I had absolutely no idea what I was supposed to do next. I hadn't booked a hotel or even looked up where the Bush Pilot Supply Store was located. Suddenly, the whole thing felt like it was never going to come to fruition. I eventually worked it out at the Avis counter, where the guy helping me let me use his computer to look up the address of the Bush Pilot Supply Store. The drive took about 30 minutes through the dark of Anchorage. The whole time I kept rehearsing what I'd say to the owner when I got there. When I finally pulled into the parking lot, the store was completely dark. A small printed sign taped to the glass door told me they opened at 7 the following morning. I stood there in the freezing December air staring at that sign, feeling defeated by such a minimal obstacle. I had to pull it together, and I drove around until I spotted a small motel a few streets down. The place was dingy, with peeling paint on the exterior walls and a flickering vacancy sign that looked older than I was. The room smelled like cigarettes and industrial cleaner, and the heater rattled constantly, but it didn't matter. I laid on top of the bedspread, fully clothed, staring at the water-stained ceiling, wondering what the hell I was doing in Alaska. I woke up the next morning before my alarm went off and immediately drove back to the store at 6:15. I sat in the rental car with the engine running for the heat. When the store finally opened, I was the first one through the door. I walked in trying to appear casual. The walls were lined with all sorts of equipment that I could not identify. Towards the back of the store, the man behind the counter was younger than I expected, maybe 31. He was sorting through invoices when I approached and asked without preamble if he was the user Arctic Supply. It was not at all how I had rehearsed it in my head. He looked up sharply with an expression that was equal parts defensive and irritated. I quickly told him that my name was Derek Parker and that I'd grown up next door to Maddie Longbaugh in Glen Falls. I explained how I'd seen his post on the forum, the photograph he'd uploaded, and that I'd flown to Alaska to find her. I even made it a point to show him my New York State driver's license. His defensive posture softened slightly, and he admitted that he was in fact the person who'd made that post. His name was Jeff Wiseman, and he'd owned the store for 8 years now. After a few minutes of talking, Jeff explained he didn't really know where Maddie was. She usually came in the first week of the month, he said, but she hadn't shown up yet this December. He couldn't say whether she'd come at all. I stood there trying to process what that meant for me. This complete stranger who'd just flown thousands of miles based on a forum post and a photograph. With no other option, I asked if I could hang around the store for a few days to see if she showed up. The request sounded desperate, even as I said it, like something a stalker would ask. Jeff looked uncomfortable with the whole situation. He shifted his weight and glanced around the store like he was looking for an excuse to say no. Finally, he agreed, but made me promise that if she hadn't appeared by the 7th, I had to leave. No exceptions. I told him that was fair and thanked him for letting me stay. I spent the rest of that first day sitting on a metal folding chair near the back of the store, watching every person who walked through the door with a mixture of hope and anxiety. I spent 2 more days sitting in that store, waiting. Each time the bell rang above the door, my chest would tighten and I'd look up expecting to see Maddie. Every single customer who walked through gave me this rush of adrenaline that would crash the moment I realized it wasn't her. By the end of the second day, I didn't actually know if I wanted to see Maddie walk through that door at all. I still didn't know what I was supposed to say to her. What was I expecting to happen? During this time, I must have checked my cell phone 100 times, hoping to see a missed call from Cheryl. I had this unbacked optimism that she would approve of what I was doing, but nothing. Just the same blank screen every time I flipped it open. On the third day, a few hours after I'd been sitting in my usual spot near the back, the bell rang above the door. I recognized her instantly from the photograph. But seeing her in person was different. She was tall, almost as tall as me, with brown hair pulled back in a practical ponytail. She wore work pants and a heavy flannel jacket. If I had passed her on the street without context, I never would have connected her to the girl I remembered from Glen Falls. She moved through the store with purpose, heading straight for the radio equipment along the far wall. I watched her browse through frequency analyzers and antenna equipment, occasionally pulling something down to examine it more closely. She talked quietly with Jeff about specifications I didn't understand, asking technical questions about signal strength and propagation patterns. I stood up from the chair and walked toward her with my legs feeling unsteady. When I said her name, she looked up from the equipment she was holding, and our eyes met. "I'm Derek Parker," I said, "from Glen Falls. We were neighbors." Her face changed immediately. Recognition washed over her features, but it wasn't the reaction I'd expected or hoped for. She looked disappointed, almost resigned. It was like she'd been caught at something she'd been hoping to avoid. Before she even responded to me, she turned her head towards Jeff at the counter. Jeff held up his hands apologetically. Maddie turned back to me, her expression carefully neutral now. "Hello, Derek." I tried to ask her questions about where she'd been, what happened that night, how she ended up in Alaska, but she just said not yet and went back to examining the radio equipment like I wasn't standing right there. I stood there feeling dumb while Maddie purchased some equipment at the counter. The whole transaction took maybe 5 minutes, but it felt like forever. When she finally finished, she picked up her bag and turned to me. "Follow me outside," she said, not waiting for an answer before pushing through the door. I followed Maddie outside into the freezing Anchorage air. "How have you been?" she asked, the question coming off flat and unenthusiastic. I told her I'd been okay, that I was living in Syracuse now, working IT at the hospital. She nodded but didn't respond. We walked in awkward silence for a few minutes through an older section of downtown Anchorage. Our breath formed clouds in the cold as we went. Finally, I couldn't take it anymore, and I asked her directly what had happened that night in 1983 and how she ended up here. Maddie stopped walking and sighed. "I don't really know." I questioned how she could mean that, and she turned to look at me with this intensity that made me want to look away. She told me that I needed to swear that I wouldn't tell anyone where she was. The way she said it made me feel guilty for the voicemail I'd left Cheryl. I didn't respond, but she went on anyway. She explained how in June of 1983, she thought she may have somehow blacked out or had some kind of memory lapse and ended up in Alaska. Just woke up here one day with no idea how she'd gotten across the country. She said she couldn't explain any of it. What disturbed me most was when she told me she'd felt no compulsion to go home or contact her family. She said it so matter-of-factly, like she was describing the weather. There was no emotion in her voice, no guilt or sadness about abandoning everyone who'd spent decades thinking she was dead. I had this overwhelming urge to question everything, to go over every detail and demand answers that made sense. But something in her expression told me now wasn't the time. Maddie must have sensed I wanted to ask more, but she simply asked where I was staying. I told her about the motel near the supply store. She nodded like she was thinking something over. Then she said she was driving back to a cabin she had in Gulkana tomorrow. It was about a 4-hour drive, she explained, but I could come if I wanted, and she'd show me what she'd been working on. I agreed without even thinking. Maddie told me to meet her in front of the store the next day at 6, and if I wasn't there, she was leaving. Then she got into her car and drove off without saying goodbye. I stood there on that Anchorage street, watching her taillights disappear, realizing I'd just agreed to drive 4 hours into the Alaskan wilderness with a woman who'd been missing for 20 years and couldn't explain how she'd gotten here. I woke up at 4:30 that morning with my heart already racing in the dark motel room. I laid there staring at the ceiling for a while, trying to convince myself that this was a reasonable thing to be doing. By 5, I was dressed and sitting in the rental car with the heater running. The whole drive over, I kept thinking how I should just turn around, go back to the airport, and forget the whole thing. But something kept me there in that parking lot, engine idling in the freezing dark. It wasn't curiosity, exactly. It was more like the sense that I'd already committed to something that I couldn't walk away from. Like I owed it to someone. Maddie showed up at 6 a.m. sharp in a beat-up Jeep that looked like it had seen better days. I climbed in without saying much, and for the first hour we barely spoke at all. She drove with her windows cracked open despite the freezing temperatures. Cold air whistled into the cab the whole time, but I didn't say anything. The highway stretched out ahead of us, empty and dark. I kept stealing glances at her in the dashboard light, trying to reconcile this woman with the 9-year-old I remembered from Glen Falls. Eventually, after we'd been driving for maybe 2 hours, Maddie finally seemed to open up a bit. She mentioned how the cabin she was taking me to was technically on government land near Gakona, but that the government probably didn't care. I didn't really believe that. I couldn't imagine any scenario where the federal government would just overlook someone squatting on their property, but I kept my mouth shut. She went on to explain what the research facility in Gakona actually did, how it was this massive array of high-frequency transmitters called HARP that study the upper atmosphere by beaming radio waves hundreds of miles into the air. The way she explained the technical details made it clear she'd been thinking about this for years. She threw in that she needed my help for something she'd been working on. When we got closer to our destination, Maddie turned off the main highway onto what could barely be considered a road. It was really just two tire tracks cutting through snow into semi-dense forests. The Jeep bounced over frozen ruts as we pushed deeper into the woods near Gakona. She drove with the confidence of someone who'd made this trip 100 times. Eventually, she pulled off into a small clearing and shut off the engine. She got out without a word, and I followed. I helped her grab some of the things she had purchased at the supply store, and we walked for maybe 8 minutes through the woods. Everything was quiet except for our footsteps in the snow. The clearing opened up ahead of us, and I could make out the shape of a small cabin. It was modest, maybe 20 by 15 feet, with rough-hewn logs and a metal roof that looked like it was barely holding on. There was a structure behind it which was larger, almost twice the size of the cabin itself. It looked like some kind of primitive garage. Inside the cabin was bleak. There was a twin bed pushed against the wall, a few radios stacked on makeshift shelves, something that might generously be called a kitchen, and a couple of chairs. The whole place felt temporary, like someone camping rather than living. Maddie put on some tea and told me she needed to check on some things in the garage before showing me anything. Then she just left me there alone in the cabin while she disappeared out back. I stood there unsure of what to do with myself. I examined the shelves where she kept the radios. There were all different kinds of models with frequencies written on masking tape labels stuck to the wood. Near the bed was a small wooden frame with a photograph. The picture showed Maddie, maybe 25 years old, standing next to a Native American man about her age. They were both smiling, standing together in a way that made them look like a couple. The photo looked like it was taken somewhere in Anchorage. I set the frame back down, and through one of the windows in the cabin, I saw Maddie walking back from the garage. She walked back in and told me to follow her. We ended up trudging through the snow to the garage, where she pulled open the heavy wooden door. The space was lit by a couple of work lights hanging from the ceiling. And the first thing that hit me was how much warmer it was inside than the cabin itself. It seemed like she had insulated it properly or had some kind of heating system running. The entire garage was packed wall to wall with radio equipment. There were massive transmitters stacked on metal shelving, antenna components organized in plastic bins, coils of copper wire hanging from hooks on the walls, and what looked like homemade control panels covered in switches and dials I couldn't even begin to understand. I stood there for a long moment just trying to take it all in. Finally, I managed to ask her if she'd built all this herself. Maddie walked over to one of the transmitters and ran her hand over the edge. She explained how most of the equipment came from Jeff's store. It was all broken or damaged stuff from other people that had given up on it. She'd buy it cheap and fix it up, then resell it for enough money to buy more components. That's how she'd scrape together enough to build the cabin and the garage, she said, one piece of equipment at a time. There was a long silence where I tried to build up the courage to ask her what this was all truly for. What was she trying to accomplish with a garage full of salvaged radio equipment in the middle of nowhere? But the words wouldn't come. Instead, all I could manage was asking what she needed help with. Maddie looked at me for a moment, then she said she needed help with one of the towers she'd made. It was only about a 20-minute ride on the sled from here, she explained. I asked what she meant by a tower, but all she said was that it wasn't that big. I couldn't picture what kind of tower she'd built out here in the woods by herself, or why she'd needed my help with it. But I'd come all this way, and turning back now was impossible. After a few more minutes in the garage, Maddie told me we should head back to the cabin. Inside the cabin, it felt much colder. Maddie moved around the small space, pulling out a couple of bowls and pots for making oatmeal. I sat down in one of the chairs, watching her work. She told me I could sleep on the bed and that she had another bed in the garage she'd sleep on. The offer caught me off guard and I immediately protested, saying I could sleep on the floor or out in the garage. But Maddie insisted, explaining she slept most nights in the garage anyway, and that the bed in the cabin rarely got used. We ate the oatmeal in silence for a while. I sat on the edge of her bed with the bowl in my hands, and for the first time since seeing Maddie, it felt like we were kids again. I asked about the picture near her bed, gesturing to the wooden frame on the small shelf. Maddie glanced over at it while eating her oatmeal and said that it was her and a man named Alex. They'd met when they were both 24, she'd explained. He was part of one of the indigenous groups in the area and had been doing construction work for one of the government facilities in Gakona. They'd met one night in Anchorage at some bar she couldn't remember the name of anymore. He'd helped her build this cabin, she said. They'd even lived together for a while, maybe 3 years in total. The way she described it made it sound like she was talking about someone from decades ago, rather than just a few years back. I asked what happened to him, why he wasn't here anymore. Maddie said he'd gotten more work down in Anchorage and eventually just stopped coming back to the cabin. She hadn't seen him in several years now, maybe 4 or 5. She wasn't even sure if he still lived in Alaska. The whole thing felt incredibly sad to me, sitting there in that freezing cabin, listening to Maddie describe her life as if it was a series of random events that happened to someone else. Maddie startled me when she said, "We even had a child together." The words hung in the air. I didn't know what to say. My mind scrambled to process what she just told me. "Does the child live with Alex?" was the only response I could manage. "No," was all she said. She stood up from her chair and walked over to the small desk near the bed. She pulled open the single drawer and rummaged through the papers and miscellaneous items for several seconds until she found what she was looking for. She turned and held a photograph toward me. I took it from her hand, looking down at it. "Whoa!" The involuntary gasp escaped before I could stop it. I pushed myself back against the wall without thinking and dropped the photo on the bed, my body reacting before my mind could catch up. I positioned myself to see the photograph while it sat on the bed. It showed Maddie in the same cabin, sitting on what looked like the bed I was on right now. She was holding something small, wrapped partially in a blanket. But the thing in her arms couldn't have been human. The proportions were horrible. The head was large and elongated with dark eyes. The skin looked sickly gray in the photograph and almost seemed translucent. And Maddie's face showed absolutely nothing. No joy or sorrow or fear, just this blank expression. I couldn't form words. My throat had closed up completely. I just stared at that photograph, trying to make sense of what I was seeing. I tried to convince myself it was trick photography or some kind of deformity I didn't understand. Maddie watched my reaction with the same blank expression from the photo until something changed in her eyes. Not anger exactly, disappointment maybe. She took the photograph back from the bed and returned it to the drawer without saying anything. The silence in the cabin felt suffocating. Finally, she just said, "We'll go out to the tower first thing in the morning," and walked out, letting the door close behind her with a soft click. I sat alone in Maddie's cabin, while the panic rising in my chest seemed to burn in my throat. My hands trembled as I gripped the edge of the bed. That photograph burned into my mind. I stood and paced the small space, my breathing coming quick and shallow. The idea of taking her car crossed my mind, but I'd watched her pocket the keys before heading into the garage. Even if I could somehow get them, I had no idea how to navigate out of these woods in the dark. I sat there, watching the garage through the window. The structure loomed in the darkness with a faint light visible through the gaps in the wooden walls. The hours crawled by and my mind raced through scenarios I couldn't fully articulate. Only then did I realize Maddie and I never actually discussed when or how I'd return to Anchorage. The whole arrangement had this unspoken quality that now felt dangerous. Around 5:15 that morning, I saw movement through the window. Maddie was walking back from the garage towards the cabin. I quickly sat back up on the bed and tried to compose myself. When she came through the door, I did my best to act normal. She looked at me without any particular expression. She walked over to a small cabinet and pulled out a granola bar, tossing it to me. Then she moved to a storage bin near the door and started pulling out winter gear. She said we'd have to take the sled and that I'd needed something warmer than what I had. She handed me a thick scarf and a larger jacket that smelled faintly of diesel and wood smoke. I put them on without questioning it. A couple of minutes later, we went outside together and she disappeared behind the garage. I heard an engine sputter to life and then she emerged on a snowmobile with some kind of utility sled attached to the back. My hands quickly became numb despite the thick gloves I was wearing as I helped her load equipment onto the attached sled. We worked quickly, and when everything was secured, she climbed onto the snowmobile and told me to get on behind her. The cold was unimaginable. Even with the extra layers Maddie had given me, the wind cut through everything as we rode through the forest. After only a few minutes, I could no longer feel my face, and I had to keep adjusting the scarf around my neck just to breathe without my lungs burning. We weaved between trees, following what might have been a trail but looked more like random gaps in the forest. The snowmobile bounced over hidden roots and frozen terrain. I had to grip the back of the seat just to stay on. It felt like it would have been impossible to know where you're going out there. Every direction looked exactly the same. Endless white and gray trees stretching in all directions. Eventually, the trees opened up into a clearing, and I saw two of them. Two tower-like structures rising against the gray Alaska sky, maybe 30 feet tall each. They were constructed from metal framework, crude but sturdy, with antenna arrays mounted at different heights along their length. "How did you build these?" I asked, my voice barely carrying over the wind. Maddie killed the engine and climbed off. "I didn't build them from scratch," she said, walking over towards the nearest tower. "They were already here when I found the place. Government probably built them years ago, then just abandoned them. I've been building onto them." I stared up at the structures, trying to understand. The towers were covered in what looked like homemade antenna arrays, copper coils wrapped around PVC piping, with clusters of equipment I couldn't identify mounted at various points along the framework. "What are you trying to do with all of this?" I asked, almost shouting over the wind while covering my face. Maddie didn't answer. She just started unloading equipment from the sled. When she had everything unloaded, she placed two pieces of equipment into a large bag and slung it over her shoulder. She told me we needed to climb the tower. She assured me that it seemed much higher than it actually was. I looked at the ladder running up the side of the nearest tower. It was just metal rungs bolted to a framework, disappearing 30 feet up into the gray sky. Everything in me wanted to tell her I wasn't climbing in these conditions. Instead, I just stood there, staring at the bottom rungs. I told myself it would be fine. Maddie was already walking towards the base of the tower, adjusting the bag on her shoulder. I let Maddie climb first, watching her ascend about 10 feet before I reached for the first rung myself. The metal was cold and it burned through my gloves, but the grip was surprisingly solid. The wind made it nearly impossible to look up and gauge how much farther I had to go. Every time I tried, frozen air cut into my eyes until I had to look back down at my hands. The structure swayed slightly with each movement, which became more pronounced the higher I climbed. I couldn't tell how high I was as I went. The worsening conditions had reduced visibility to maybe 15 feet in any direction. Below me was just white. My breathing came in short, controlled bursts. I focused only on the next rung and then the next, keeping the rhythm steady. I tried not to think about the height or the wind, just keep climbing. When I finally reached the top platform, Maddie was already kneeling beside an open equipment panel, tools spread out around her on the metal grating. She didn't look up when I pulled myself onto the platform. "I need to replace something that got taken out in the last storm," she said. Her voice seemed to carry through the wind without her having to raise it at all. I realized she never even covered her face or ducked away from the freezing blasts of air that kept cutting through my exposed skin until it burned. I watched Maddie work for a few minutes, trying to ask what she was doing, but the wind was so strong I had to shout just to make my voice heard over the howling gusts that whipped across the platform. Finally, Maddie seemed to finish her work. She pulled some lever and there was a loud humming that emitted from the tower. The whole structure vibrated beneath my feet. She turned to me and stated, "This is how I talk to God." I tried to shout, "What?" over the wind, but she didn't explain. She pulled the lever again into some sort of middle position. The tower now echoed a loud, growling hum that cut through the wind in a way that made my teeth ache. "I need you to tell me what you hear," she said. I stood there on that platform, 30 feet above the frozen Alaska wilderness, listening to the tower emit its terrible growl. "I don't hear anything," I shouted back, "just the humming." Maddie adjusted something on the equipment panel and the growl seemed to shift in pitch. I closed my eyes and tried to focus past the wind and the mechanical hum. For a long moment, there was nothing but those two sounds competing for dominance. Then, buried underneath everything else, I thought I heard something that might have been a voice, distant and garbled, like listening to a radio station that was almost but not quite tuned properly. "I think I hear voices," I called out. Maddie nodded once and then pulled the lever back to its original position. The growling stopped immediately and the sudden silence was almost worse than the noise had been. The wind suddenly died as well. Maddie turned to look at me with an expression I couldn't read. Every day I ask myself, am I a child of God, or have I had God's child? Before I could even process what she'd said, and before I could form any kind of response, something from the sky above began to emit a terrible sound. It wasn't like anything I'd ever heard. It was not a hum, or a tone, or a mechanical noise. It was somehow all of those things and none of them. The sound cut straight through my skull, bypassing my ears completely and vibrating directly into my brain. My ears erupted. I felt warmth running down both sides of my neck, and when I touched my hand to it, my gloves came away with dark blood. The sound came in waves, terrible pulses that made my vision blur and my knees buckle. Between each pulse, there was maybe a second of silence where I could think clearly enough to scream. "We need to leave," I shouted during one of those breaks. grabbing at the railing of the platform. Maddie just paced back and forth on the metal grating, completely unbothered. She moved with ease, checking equipment panels and adjusting dials while I collapsed to my knees, gripping the safety bar to keep from falling through the grating. The sound came again, worse this time, and I felt something warm trickling from my nose now. My whole body seized up with each pulse, every muscle contracting involuntarily. Addie was suddenly crouched next to me, her face inches from mine. She pulled something from her jacket and slid it into my front pocket. "This is what I need you to do for me, Derek." One last noise erupted from the sky, worse than all the others. My vision went completely white and then black. I felt my body convulsing and couldn't control it. When my vision finally came back, I couldn't tell if seconds or minutes had passed. The platform was completely silent. The wind had returned, howling across the metal grating, but the terrible sound from the sky was gone. So was Maddie. I pulled myself to my feet, gripping the railing. "Maddie!" My voice came out hoarse and damaged. I looked around the small platform frantically. Nothing. Just the equipment and tools scattered around where she'd been working moments before. I stumbled to the ladder, my legs barely holding me as I descended. The climb down felt endless. My hands were shaking so badly I nearly lost my grip twice. Blood from my nose and ears had frozen against my skin. When I reached the bottom, I searched the clearing around the tower's base. No footprints in the snow. Even the ones we had made when we got there were filled entirely. No sign of her anywhere. Eventually, I climbed back onto the snowmobile. It groaned to life very slowly. I just started riding, hoping I was heading in the right direction. The frozen landscape all looked exactly the same, and I had no idea if I was even going the right way. I rode for what felt like hours until the cabin finally started to appear through the trees. I found the keys to Maddie's Jeep sitting on the workbench in the garage, right where she must have left them. Before I left, I went back into the cabin one last time and opened up the desk drawer. I pulled out the photograph she'd shown me the night before and slipped it into my jacket pocket. The drive back to the highway took twice as long as it should have. I kept getting turned around on those unmarked forest roads, but eventually I found my way. I didn't remember the note in my jacket pocket until I was halfway back to Anchorage. My hands were still shaking on the steering wheel when I reached into my pocket with one hand, fumbling for whatever Maddie had shoved in there on the tower. My fingers closed around a folded piece of paper. I pulled it out and unfolded it against the steering wheel while trying to keep my eyes on the highway. There was just an address written in Maddie's handwriting, nothing else. No explanation, no instructions, just a street address in Fishhook, Alaska. I had no idea where that was or how to get there at the time. I fumbled for my phone with freezing fingers, hoping that I finally had a signal so I could call 911 for Maddie. The screen stayed completely black when I tried to power it on. Dead. I pulled over onto the shoulder and tried again with both hands. The phone was just completely dead. It had been fully charged when I left that morning. I pulled back onto the highway, heading towards Anchorage. I kept thinking I needed to go straight to the police station. That was the logical thing to do. Tell them everything that had happened. Show them the photograph. Give them the address Maddie had slipped into my pocket. A woman had just disappeared right in front of me on top of that tower, and I needed to report it. But the more I thought about what I'd actually say, the crazier it all sounded. I'd tell them that I flew to Alaska, chasing a woman who had been missing for 24 years, that she'd taken me to some illegal structure she built on government land, that we'd climbed a tower and activated equipment that made sounds come from the sky, and then she'd just vanished into thin air while my ears bled. They'd think I was completely insane, or worse, they'd think I'd done something to her. I could hardly prove any of it. The towers were out there in the middle of nowhere, on unmarked land. The cabin was miles from anything, and my only evidence was a photograph of something that looked inhuman and an address written on a piece of paper. Then it hit me, the voicemail I'd left Cheryl. I told her exactly where I was going and what I was doing. I even mentioned the supply store, and Jeff knew my full name. He had seen my driver's license. Too many people knew I'd come to Alaska to just disappear without reporting something. If I didn't go to the police, if I just got on a plane back to Syracuse and never said a word about any of this, eventually someone would start asking questions. Cheryl might call the police herself. I needed a story that made sense, something that didn't sound completely insane, but still explained why I'd been there. I drove for another hour before I finally worked out what I could tell them. I pulled into the Anchorage Police Department around 7 that evening. It looked like a newer building that had been constructed within the last decade. I sat in the Jeep for a moment, trying to steady my breathing. Inside, the lobby was bright and sterile with fluorescent lights that made everything look washed out. 3 people stood in line ahead of me at the main desk, and I took my place behind them. The wait felt like forever. Each person ahead of me seemed to have some complicated situation that required lengthy explanations in multiple forms. I kept glancing at the clock on the wall, watching the minutes crawl by. My fingers drummed against my leg, and I couldn't stop fidgeting with the photograph in my pocket. After 25 minutes, I finally reached the front of the line. A woman in her 40s sat behind thick glass, looking tired. "I need to report a missing persons," I said, raising my voice unnecessarily to be heard over the glass. She slid a clipboard under the glass partition. "I'll need you to fill this out. Name, date of birth, address." I started writing my information, my hands still shaking slightly as I filled in the blanks. I finished as fast as I could, and the woman took the clipboard back and seemed to start entering it into the system. She looked up at me and then back down again at the form and then up to me again. "One moment, please," she said, standing abruptly. She disappeared through a door behind the desk, leaving me standing there alone in the lobby. The people in line behind me shifted impatiently. 5 minutes passed, and then 10. I was about to ask someone what was happening when the door finally opened again. The woman returned with a police officer, a man in his early 40s with light hair and a serious expression. He was holding my intake form and studied it carefully. "Derek Parker?" he asked. "Yes." "Can you confirm your date of birth for me?" I looked confused. "November 12th, 1967. The officer exchanged a glance with the woman behind the desk. "And you're from Syracuse, New York, right?" "That's right. Look, I need to report Mr. Parker," the officer interrupted. "I need you to come with me for a moment." He buzzed open a side door and gestured for me to follow him. We walked down a short hallway into a small office. He closed the door behind us and indicated I should sit. "Mr. Parker, I need you to confirm your identity again. Do you have any identification on you?" I pulled out my wallet and handed him my driver's license. He studied it for a long moment and then looked up at me. "Mr. Parker, according to our records, you've been a missing person since 2008. The words didn't make sense to me. "That's impossible." The officer looked up again. "I'm looking at the file right now," he said, turning his computer monitor so I could see it. There was my name, my date of birth, a photograph that looked exactly like me. Status, missing. Last seen, December 2nd, 2008, Anchorage, Alaska. "No," I said, shaking my head. "That doesn't make sense. 2008 is this year. It's December 2008 right now." The officer's expression looked concerned. "Mr. Parker, it's December 2014. The room tilted. I gripped the edge of the desk, feeling dizzy and disoriented. What? The current year is 2014. You've been missing for 6 years. I stumbled backwards, my legs hitting the chair behind me. 6 years, that was impossible. I'd left Syracuse 3 days ago. I'd flown to Anchorage on December 3rd, 2008. I'd waited at the supply store. I'd gone to the cabin with Maddie. That had all just happened. I don't understand, I managed to say. Mr. Parker, I need you to stay calm. Can you tell me where you've been for the last 6 years? I opened my mouth to answer, but couldn't form words. My mind was racing, trying to make sense of what he was telling me. 6 years? It had been 6 years since I'd left Syracuse? I made a sudden movement and stumbled out of the interview room, feeling like the floor was dissolving beneath my feet. The officer called after me, saying something about needing to ask more questions, but I just kept walking. My mind couldn't process what he'd just told me. I pushed through the glass door into the freezing Anchorage night and climbed into Maddie's Jeep. I pulled out of the parking lot too fast, my tire skidding slightly on the ice. I had no idea where I was going. I drove through the dark streets for maybe 10 minutes before pulling into a gas station. I walked quickly inside, scanning the aisles until I found newspaper stacked near the nearest register. My hands trembled as I picked one up. The date printed at the top read December 8th, 2014. I stood there, staring at those numbers. I put the newspaper back and I felt sweat beating on my forehead despite the cold outside. I scanned the aisles until I spotted what I needed, a travel map book of the area. I grabbed it and spread it across the counter. "Where's Fishhook?" I asked the clerk quickly. He looked at me with suspicion, probably noticing the blood still crusted around my ears, but he leaned over the map and pointed to a spot in the northeast part of Anchorage. "Right here, maybe 50 minutes, little less than an hour." I yanked a 10 from my wallet and dropped it on the counter without waiting for change. The clerk called after me, but I was already pushing through the door, back into the freezing night. My breath came in short bursts as I climbed into the Jeep and pulled the map close to the dome light, memorizing the route to Fishhook. I tried the radio on the drive, desperate for any proof that this was all some terrible misunderstanding, but the unit was completely dead. The road to Fishhook took me through northeast, through the empty darkness. Every few miles, I'd glance down at the address Maddie had written, like the numbers may have changed when I wasn't looking. I kept replaying those final moments on the tower platform. The sound from the sky, Maddie's face showing nothing while my ears bled. The way she slipped that note into my pocket like she'd known exactly what was going to happen. When I finally got to the area that was supposed to be Fishhook, according to the map, I saw signs for Independence Mine State Historical Park keep appearing along the roadside, but nothing that matched the exact address Maddie had written. The scattered houses and buildings didn't follow any logical numbering system I could understand. I finally noticed a small walking path leading off the main road into the trees. I pulled the Jeep onto the shoulder and killed the engine. The path was narrow and barely visible under the snow. It was marked only by a gap in the tree line. The trees closed in around me as I followed the path deeper into the woods. After maybe 5 minutes of uncertainty, the path opened into a small clearing. A shipping container sat in the middle of the clearing, half buried in snow. Metal was rusted and old with frost clinging to its sides. I approached slowly with my boots crunching through the frozen surface. On the side panel near the door was a metal tag with numbers stamped onto it. I pulled out the note from my pocket and held it up in the moonlight. The address matched exactly. I tried to collect myself, staring at that container for a long time. Maddie had put this address in my pocket for a reason. I reached for the heavy door latch and pulled. The metal groaned as it swung open. A faint light spilled out from within. I pulled the door wider and saw it. The thing was maybe 4 feet tall. Its skin was that same terrible gray from the photograph. almost translucent in the dim light. Its disgustingly proportioned arms and legs were chained to the wall. The light flickered in its dark eyes, and I could tell it was looking at me. Then it spoke, if you could call it that. The sounds that it made weren't words, more like tones that somehow assembled themselves into meaning inside of my head. I shouldn't have been able to understand it, but I did. It said, "Release me." Standing there in the doorway of that shipping container, I stared at the thing that Maddie had left chained in the backwoods of Fishhook, Alaska. The creature that might have been hers. The thing that had been waiting here for someone to find it.